At last, he stood before the door of the throne room. The voices were louder than ever, all seeming to cry out from inside the great chamber. He reached a hand down. The door was not locked. As he pushed it open, the voices stilled, as though startled into silence by the creak of the hinges. The misty light poured out past him like shimmering smoke. He stepped inside. The yellowing throne, the dragonbone chair, stood in the room's center. Around it danced a linked circle of figures, hands clasped, moving as slowly as though they were in deep, deep water. He recognized several: Judith, Rachel, Jacob the Chandler, and other castle folk, their faces stretched with wild merriment as they bowed and capered. Among them moved dancers more grand: King Elias, Guthwulf of Utanyit, Gwythyn of Hernesteer. These, like the castle folk, wheeled as slowly and deliberately as ageless ice, grinding mountains down to dust. Scattered about the silent circle were looming figures, shiny black as beetles. The Malachite kings come down from their pedestals to join the sluggish festivity. And in the middle bulked the great chair, a skull-peaked mountain of dull ivory that seemed somehow full of vitality, suffused with an ancient energy that held the circling dancers by taut, invisible reins. The throne room was silent, but for a thin thread of melody that wavered in the air. The Cansim Phalis, the hymn to joy. The tune was stretched and discomforting, as if the invisible hands that plucked it out were not made to handle earthly instruments. Simon felt himself drawn toward the terrible dance, as to a whirlpool. He dragged his feet, but still moved inexorably inward. The dancers' heads turned toward his approach with a slow, twisting motion, like the unwinding of crumpled stems of grass. In the center of the ring, on the dragonbone chair itself, a darkness was coalescing. A darkness of many flittering parts, like a cloud of flies. Near the top of this swarming, rolling dark, two smoldering sparks of crimson began to brighten, as though fanned by a sudden breeze. The dancers were staring at him now as they swam by, mouthing his name. Simon! 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 On the far side of the ring, beyond the crawling obscurity on the throne, a gap opened, two clasped hands sliding apart like the tearing of a rotted rag. As the opening moved around to him, one of the hands fluttered out in fish-like undulation. It was Rachel's. And as she neared, she beckoned to him. Instead of her usual look of suspicion, her face was set in lines of desperate cheerfulness. She reached out. Across from her, fat Jeremias held the gap open, a dull smile on his pale features. "Come, boy," Rachel said, or at least it was her lips that moved. The voice, soft and hoarse, was a man's. "Come, can you not feel the place we have left for you? A place especially prepared." The grasping hand caught at his collar and began to pull him into the dance's orbit. He struggled, slapping at the clammy fingers, but his arms were strengthless. Rachel's and Jeremiah's lips split in wide grins. The voice deepened.
"Boy, don't you hear me? Come on, boy."
"No!"
The cry came out at last, leaping from the prison of Simon's constricted throat.
"No, I won't, no!"
"Oh, Freja's got us, boy, wake up. You've woken everyone else."
The hand shook him again roughly, and there was a sudden gleam of light. Simon sat up, tried to scream, and fell back in a coughing fit. A dark shape leaned over him, starkly outlined by an oil lamp.
"Actually, the boy hasn't really wakened anyone," Iskrimnor realized. "The rest of them have been tossing and moaning since I walked in, like they were all having the same nightmare. What a god's cursed, strange night."
The Duke watched as the restless shapes around him slowly lapsed back into quietude, then returned his attention to the boy.
"Look there, the little puppy is coughing something fierce. Truthfully, though, he's not so little, just thin as a starveling colt."
Iskrimnor put the lantern down in a niche, then pulled the sheet of homespun stretched across the alcove to one side, so he could get a good grip on the youth's shoulder. He pulled the boy upright in bed and gave him a firm swat on the back. The boy coughed once more and then stopped. Escrimnor patted him a few more times with a wide, hairy hand.
Sorry, fellow, sorry. Take your time there.
While the youth regained his breath, the Duke looked around the curtained-off alcove, in which the boy's slat bed was set. From beyond the drooping cloth came the murmuring night sounds of the dozen or so scullions bedded nearby. Escrimnor picked up the lantern again, peering at the odd shapes pegged on the shadowed wall. An unraveling bird's nest, a silky streamer. It looked green in the poor lamplight. That had probably come from some night's festival gear. Nearby, also hanging from nails driven into cracks, were a hawk feather, a crude wooden tree, and a picture whose ragged edge showed it to be torn from a book. Squinting, Escrimnor thought he could make out a staring man with wild hair standing out from his head. Or were they antlers? When he looked down again, smiling to himself at the unholy clutter of younglings, the boy had regained his breath. He was looking up at the Duke with wide, nervous eyes.
With that nose and thatch of, what is it, red hair, the boy looks like a bedamned marsh bird, Escrimnor thought. Sorry to startle you, the old Duke said, but you were closest to the door. I need to speak to Towser, the jester. Do you know who he is?
The boy nodded, watching his face intently.
Good, thought the Rimmer's man. At least he isn't simple-minded. I was told that he dossed down here tonight, but I don't see him. Where is he?
You're...
The youth was having trouble coming out with it.
Yes, I'm the Duke of Elvritzhala, and don't start in bowing and sirring. Just tell me where the jester is, and I'll let you back to sleep.
With that another word, the boy slid off his pallet and stood up, pulling his blanket free and wrapping it about his shoulders. The hem of his shirt hung down below, flapping against bare legs, as he stepped over the slumbering men around him. Some of whom lay wrapped in their cloaks in the middle of the floor, as though they had not been able to make it all the way to their beds. Escrimnor followed with the lamp, stepping carefully over the dark forms, as though he followed one of Udon's ghost maidens through a field of battle slain. They went through two more rooms this way, the big spirit and the small, the larger just as silent for all his bulk. In the last room, a few dim coals sparkled in the fireplace. On the bricks before the grate, curled in a nest of coats and with a sheepskin wine bag still gripped in his horny old fist, Towser the jester lay snoring and mumbling.
Ah, Escrimnor grunted. Well, thanks then, boy. Go back to your bed with my apologies. Although I think you were dreaming a dream you'd be just as happy to wake from. Go on now.
The youth turned and went back past Escrimnor toward the doorway. As he brushed by, the Duke was mildly surprised to note that the youth was nearly as tall as he was. And Escrimnor was not a small man. It was the boy's slenderness and the way he hunched when he walked that made his size less evident.
It's a pity nobody's taught that one to stand up, he thought. And most likely he never will learn in the kitchens or wherever.
When the youth had disappeared a moment later, Escrimnor bent and shook Towser. Gently at first, then with increasing vigor as it became apparent that the little man was well and truly swatted. Even the firmest agitation produced only faint noises of protest. At last, Escrimnor's patience ended. He bent down, clutching one of the older man's ankles in each hand, and pulled them up in the air until Towser dangled upside down, only the crown of his bald head touching the floor. Towser's grumbling turned to gurgles of discomfort, and at last became good, understandable, westerling words.
What? Down! Put down! Aiden, damn you!
If you don't wake up, old sass, I shall knock your head against the ground until you think wine is poison forever!
Escrimnor wedded word to deed, lifting the jester's ankles a few handspans, then setting his head back down none too gently on the cold stone.
Desist! Demon, I surrender! Turn me round, man, turn me round. I am not Osiris to hang heels or head for the instruction of the masses.
Escrimnor lowered him gently until the little jester lay stretched full length on his back.
Don't add blasphemy to besottedness, old fool, Escrimnor growled.
Watching Towser roll painfully onto his stomach, the Duke failed to see a slender shadow take up a position in the doorway behind him.
Oh, merciful, merciful Aiden, Towser groaned as he levered himself into a sitting position. Did you have to use my head for a digging stick? If it is a well you wish to scrape, I could have told you. The ground is too stony here in the servants' chambers.
Enough, Towser. I didn't wake you 2 hours before sunrise to bandy jokes. Joshua is gone.
Towser rubbed his crown, searching blindly with the other hand for his wineskin.
Gone where, Escrimnor? For pity's sake, man, have you broken my pate because Joshua failed to meet you somewhere? I had nothing to do with it, I promise you.
He took a long, self-pitying swig from the bag.
Idiot, Escrimnor said, but his tone was not harsh. I mean the prince is gone. Left the Hayholt. Impossible, said Towser firmly,
recovering some of his self-possession with his second trembling swallow of Malmsey.
He is not leaving until next week. He said so. He told me I could go with him if I wished then, and be his jester at Naglimond.
Towser leaned his head to the side and spat.
I told him I would give him my answer tomorrow. Today, I suppose, now. Since Elias doesn't seem to care if I stay or I go.
He shook his head.
And me, his father's dearest companion.
Escrimnor shook his head impatiently, his grey-shot beard wagging. No, man, he is gone, left sometime after middle night, as far as I can tell. Or so said the Urken guardsman I found at his empty chamber, when I went to keep a meeting time with him. He had asked me to come so late, though I would have rather been abed. But he said it was something that would not wait. Does that sound like a man who would leave without even a message for me?
Who knows? Said Towser, his wrinkled face screwed up as he pondered. Mayhap that is why he wished to speak to you, because he was leaving, secretly. Then why did he not wait till I arrived? I do not like it.
Escrimnor squatted down and poked at the coals with a stick lying there.
There is a queer air in the halls of this house tonight. Joshua is often strange in his actions, said Towser with calm assurance.
He is moody. By the Lord, is he moody? He has probably gone out to hunt owls by moonlight, or some other tricksy pastime. Fear not.
After a long moment of silence, Escrimnor let out a long breath.
Ah, I am sure you're right, he said,
and his tone was quite nearly convincing.
Even were he and Elias at open odds, nothing could ever happen here in his father's house, before God and the court.
Nothing but you thumping me on the head in the middle night. God seems to be a bit slow in doling out punishments tonight.
Towser grinned a wrinkly grin. As the two men carried on their talking, voices hushed near the dull embers, Simon stole quietly back to his bed. He lay awake for some long time, wrapped in his blanket, staring up into the darkness. But by the time the cock in the courtyard below finally saw the sun's first rising glow, he had fallen back into sleep.
Now you just remember, Morghenes cautioned, wiping the sweat from his forehead with a bright blue kerchief. Don't eat anything until you've brought it back and asked me, especially if it has red spots. Understood? Many of the articles I've asked you to gather are direst poison. Avoid stupidity, if such a thing is possible. Simon, You are in charge, boy. I hold you responsible for the safety of the others.
The others were Jeremias the Chandler's lad, and Isaac, a young page from the upstairs residence. The doctor had picked this hot Feyever afternoon to organize a mushroom and herb hunting expedition to the Kinswood, a small forest of less than 100 acres that huddled on the high bank of the Kinsler along the Hayholt's western wall. Because of the drought, Morgani's supplies of important commodities had dwindled alarmingly, and the Kinswood, standing as it did beside the Great Lake, seemed a good place to search for the doctor's moisture-loving treasures. As they fanned out through the forest, Jeremias hung back, waiting until the sound of Morgani's crunching footsteps had diminished into the crackly brown undergrowth.
"Have you asked him yet?"
Jeremiah's clothes were already so wet with perspiration that they clung.
"No."
Simon had squatted down to watch a press gang of ants hurrying single file up the trunk of a vestivec pine. "I'm going to do it today. I just have to think of the right way to do it."
"What if he says no?"
Jeremiah eyed the procession with some distaste.
"What will we do then?"
"He won't say no." Simon stood up.
"And if he does? Well, I'll think of something." "What are you two whispering about?"
Young Isaac had reappeared in the clearing.
"It's not right to keep secrets."
Though he was some 3 or 4 years younger than Simon and Jeremias, Isaac had already developed an upstairs tone. Simon scowled at him.
"Never you mind."
"We were looking at this tree,"
Jeremias offered, quick to feel guilt.
"I should have thought,"
Isaac said archly,
"that there were plenty of trees to look at without skulking and telling secrets."
"Oh, but this one," Jeremias began, "this one is..."
"Forget the stupid tree," said Simon in disgust. "Let's go.
Morganis has gotten the jump on us and will let us know if he outgathers us." He ducked a branch and waded into the ankle-high tangle of undergrowth. It was hard work. When they stopped to drink water and rest in the shade some hour and a half later, all three of the boys were covered in fine red dust up to their elbows and knees. Each carried a small bundle of goods wrapped in his kerchief. Simon's the largest, Isaac's and Jeremiah's of more modest size. They found a large spruce which they shed as a backrest, dusty legs fanning out around it like the spokes on a wheel. Simon tossed a stone across the clearing. It thumped into a pile of broken branches, setting dead leaves a-tremble.
"Why is it so hot?"
moaned Jeremias, swabbing his brow.
"And why is my handkerchief full of ridiculous mushrooms, so that I have to wipe the sweat away with my hands?"
He held up slick, wet palms.
"It's hot because it's hot," Simon grumbled,
"because there's no rain. And that's that."
A longish stretch of time passed in silence. Even the insects and birds seemed to have disappeared, gone to dark places to sleep the dry, still afternoon away in silence.
"I suppose we should be glad we are not at Merrimund," said Jeremias at last. "They say that 1,000 have died there from the plague."
1,000?
Said Isaac, scornful. The heat had brought high colour to his thin, pale face.
"Thousands? It is the talk of the residents. My master goes about the Hayholt with a kerchief doused in holy water, clapped to his face, and the plague has not come within 100 leagues of here."
"Does your master know what is happening in Merrimund?" Simon asked, interested. Isaac did have his uses.
"Does he speak of it to you?" "All the time,"
the young page was smug.
"His wife's brother is the mayor. They were among the first to flee the plague. He has gotten much news from them."
"Elias made Guthwulf of Atenyi the king's hand," said Simon. Jeremiah groaned and slid away from the trunk, stretching out full length on the pine-needle-matted ground.
"That's right," Isaac replied, scratching in the dirt with a long twig. "And he has kept the plague there.
It has not spread.
What caused it, this pestilence? Simon asked. Do any of the residence people know? He felt stupid asking questions of a child so much younger than himself. But Isaac did hear the upstairs gossip, and was not reticent in sharing it.
Nobody knows for sure. Some people say that jealous Hernestir merchants from Abengeat across the river poison the wells. Many people in Abengeat have died too.
Isaac said this with a certain air of satisfaction. After all, the Hernestiri were not Adonites, but heathens, however noble an ally the House of Luth might be under the High King's ward.
Others say that the drought has cracked the earth with dryness, and poisonous airs have escaped from the ground. Whatever it is, my master says that it spares nobody, rich man, priest, or peasant. You first become hot and feverish.
Jeremias, on his back, groaned and mopped at his forehead.
Then you blister up, like you had laid on hot coals. Then the blisters begin to ooze.
He emphasized this last word with a childish grimace, fine blonde hair hanging in his flushed face.
And then you die, painfully.
The forest breathed heat around them as they sat without speaking.
My master Jacob, Jeremiah said at last, fears that the plague shall come to the hayholt, on account of all the dirty peasants living by the walls.
The kinswood took another slow breath.
Reuben the Bear, the blacksmith, told my master that he had gotten news from a mendicant friar that Guthwulf has taken very harsh measures in Merrimund.
Harsh measures? Simon asked, eyes closed. What does that mean?
The friar told Reuben that Guthwulf, when he arrived in Merrimund as King's Hand, took the Erkingard and went to the homes of the sick. They took hammers, nails, and boards, and sealed the houses up.
With the people inside?
Simon asked, horrified but fascinated.
Of course, to stop the spread of plague. They boarded up the houses so families of the deceased could not run away and spread the plague to others.
Jeremias raised his sleeve and mopped again.
But I thought the plague came from bad airs, from the ground.
Even so, it can be spread. That is why so many priests and monks and leeches have died. The friar said that at night, for many weeks, the streets of Merrimund were, what did he say? Like the halls of hell. You could hear the people howling like dogs in the boarded up houses. Finally, when they all went silent, Guthwulf and the Erkingard burned them, unopened.
As Simon marvelled at this last detail, there was a sound of breaking branches.
Ho there, you lazy lumps!
Morghenis appeared from a knot of trees, his robes festooned with twigs and leaves, a fringe of moss clinging to the brim of his wide hat.
I should have known I would find you flat on your backs.
Simon struggled to his feet.
We have only been sitting a short while, Doctor, he said. We gathered for a long time. Don't forget to ask him,
hissed Jeremias, pulling himself up.
Well,
Morghenis said, eyeing their bundles critically,
I suppose you have not done badly, considering the conditions. Let me see what you have found.
He squatted like a farmer weeding a hedgerow, and began sifting through the boy's collections.
Ah, devil's ear!
He cried, holding a scalloped mushroom up to the shaft of sunlight.
Excellent!
Doctor, Simon said, I wanted to ask you a favor.
Hmm?
Morghenis was poking through bits of fungus, using an unrolled kerchief as a table.
Well, Jeremias is interested in joining the guards, or trying to.
The problem is, Count Breogar knows us castle folk hardly at all, and Jeremias has no connection into such circles.
That, said Morghenis dryly, is no surprise.
He emptied out the next kerchief.
Do you think you could write him a letter of introduction? You are well known to all.
Simon tried to keep his voice calm. Isaac looked at sweating Jeremias with a mixture of respect and amusement. The doctor's tone was neutral.
I suspect I am only too well known to Breogar and his friends.
He looked up, fixing Jeremias with a sharp eye.
Does Jacob know?
He knows my failings,
stammered Jeremias. Morganis bundled all the gatherings together in a sack and returned the boy's kerchiefs. The doctor stood, shaking the clinging leaves and tree needles from his robe.
I suppose I could,
he said as they started back toward the hayholt.
I don't think I approve, and I don't think a note from me will quite bring them to respectful attention. But I suppose if Jacob knows, then it's all right.
They waded single file through the scratching thicket.
Thank you, Doctor, said Jeremias breathlessly, struggling to keep up. I doubt they shall want you,
Isaac sounded a little envious. As they moved closer to the castle, his haughtiness seemed to return apace.
Dr. Morganis,
Simon said, mustering as best he could a tone of benign unconcern.
Why don't I write the letter, and then you can look at it and sign it? It would be good practice for me, don't you think?
Why, Simon,
the doctor said, stepping over a fallen tree trunk.
That's an excellent idea. I'm glad to see you take such initiative. Maybe I will make a true apprentice of you yet.
The doctor's cheerful statement, his tone of pride, weighed Simon down like a cape of lead. He hadn't done anything yet, let alone anything bad, and already he felt like a murderer or some worse thing. He was about to say something else when the stifling forest air was ripped by a scream. Simon turned around to see Jeremias, his face white as wheat paste, pointing at something in a thicket beside the fallen log. Isaac stood beside him, frozen in shock. Simon hurried back, Morganis only a step behind him. It was a corpse, lying tumbled half in and half out of the thicket. Although the face was mostly covered by bushes, the near fleshless state of the exposed parts showed that the body had been dead for some time.
Oh, 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 gasped Jeremias. He's dead. Are there outlaws here? What shall we do?
Oh, hush, snapped Morganis. That will be a start. Let me have a look.
The doctor picked up the hem of his robe and waded forward into the thicket, then stopped and gingerly lifted the branches that masked much of the body. From the tendrils of beard that still clung to his bird and insect-gnawed face, he seemed to have been a northerner, a rimmersman, perhaps. He wore unremarkable traveling clothes, a light wool cloak and tanned leather boots, rotting now so that bits of the fur lining showed through.
How did he die? Asked Simon.
The eyeless sockets, dark and secretive, unnerved him. The toothy mouth, flesh shrunken and pulled away, seemed to be grinning, as though the cadaver had been lying here for weeks, enjoying a bleak joke. Morganis used a stick to pull the tunic aside. A few flies rose lazily and circled.
Look, he said.
From a puckered hole in the corpse's desiccated trunk rose the stump of an arrow, broken off a hand's breadth above the ribs.
Done by someone in a hurry, perhaps. Someone who did not want their arrow recognized.
They had to wait a moment for Isaac to finish being noisily ill before they could hurry on to the castle. Chapter 9 Smoke on the Wind.
Did you get it? Did he guess?
Still pale for all his hours in the sun, Jeremias bobbed along at Simon's side, like the sheep's bladder float on a fisherman's net.
I've got it,
Simon growled. Jeremias' agitation irritated him. It seemed out of keeping with the masculine gravity of their mission.
You think too much.
Jeremias took no offense.
As long as you've got it, he said.
Main row opened to the harsh noontide sky. Tent roofing skinned back was nearly deserted. Here and there the constabulary guard,
yellow-liveried to show their immediate allegiance to Count Breugar, bearing sashes of Elias royal green, lounged in the doorways or diced with one another against the walls of shuttered shops. Even though the morning market was long over, still it seemed to Simon that there were fewer common people in the streets than was usual. Those to be seen were mostly the homeless, who had been flooding into Urchester in the recent winter months, driven out of the countryside by drying streams and failing wells. They stood or sat in the shadows of stone walls and buildings, knots of indifference, their movements slow and purposeless. The constables pushed past or stepped over them as though they were dogs in the street. The pair turned right off Main Row onto Tavern Way, the largest of the thoroughfares running perpendicular to the row. Here there was more activity, although still the largest number of folk in sight were soldiers. The heat had driven most of them indoors. They leaned out of the low windows with flagons in their hands, watching Simon and Jeremias and the half a dozen or so other pedestrians with beery disinterest. A peasant girl in a homespun skirt, some ostler's daughter most likely, by the jug she balanced on her shoulder, hurried past up the street. A few soldiers whistled and called out to her, spilling great sloshes of beer into the dust below the tavern windowsills. The girl did not look up as she trotted by, chin on chest. Her haste, combined with the heavy jug, kept her steps short. Simon watched the fluid sway of her hips appreciatively, even turning completely around to keep her in view until she swooped abruptly into an alleyway and disappeared.
"Simon, come on!" Jeremias called. "There it is!"
In the middle of the block of buildings, standing up from Tavern Row like a rock in a rutted road, stood St. Sutrin's Cathedral, the stone of its great face dully reflected the patient sun. Its tall arches and vaulting buttresses cast thin shadows over the nests of gargoyles, whose lively twisted faces peered down happily, cackling and joking over the shoulders of the humorless saints. Three limp pennants hung from the flagpole over the high double doors, Elias Green Dragon, the pillar and tree of the church, and at the bottom the gold coronet of Urchester Town on a white field. A pair of constabulary guards leaned on the open doors, their pikes point down in the wide stone doorway.
"Well, here's for it," said Simon grimly,
and with Jeremias trotting at his heels he made his way up the 24 marble steps. At the top one of the guards lifted his pike lazily and barred their entrance. His chainmail hood was pulled back, hanging like a veil across his shoulders.
"What do you want, then?" he asked, narrowing his eyes.
"A message for Breugar."
Simon was embarrassed to hear his voice break.
"For Count Breugar, from Dr. Morgani's at the Hayholt."
A little defiantly, he thrust out the rolled parchment. The guardsman who had spoken took it and gave the seal a cursory glance. The other was staring intently up at the carved door lintel, as if hoping to see written there his dismissal from duty for the day. The first guard handed the parchment back with a shrug.
"Inside and to the left. Don't be scamping about."
Simon drew himself up to his full height, indignant. When he was a guardsman, he would carry himself with a great deal more style than these bored, unshaven idiots. Didn't they know what an honor it was to wear the king's green? He and Jeremias climbed past them into St. Sutrin's cool interior. Nothing moved in the antechamber, not even the air, but Simon could see the play of light on figures in motion beyond the far doorway. Instead of going directly to the door on the left, he looked back to see if the guards were watching. They weren't, of course. Then strode forward to look into the cathedral's grand chapel.
"Simon!" Jeremias hissed, alarmed. "What are you doing? They said over there."
He pointed to the leftmost doorway. Ignoring his companion, Simon leaned his head through the doorway. Jeremias, muttering nervously, came up behind.
"It's like one of those religious pictures," Simon thought, "where you see Osiris in the tree way in the back, and the faces of Navinay peasants, and all very close up front."
Indeed, The chapel was so large and high-ceilinged that it seemed a whole world. Sunlight, softened by the coloured windows as though by clouds, streamed down from the uppermost reaches. White-robed priests moved around the altar, cleaning and polishing like shaven-headed chambermaids. Simon supposed they were preparing for the Elysium Mansa services only a week or two away. Closer to the door, moving equally busily, but with no other common reference, Breogar's yellow-tuniced constables milled back and forth on various errands, dotted here and there with the green of one of the castle's Erkengard, or the dun or black clothes of some Urchester notable. The two groups seemed completely separated. It took a moment for Simon to see the row of boards and stools that had been mounted between the front and back of the cathedral. In a flash of insight, Simon realized that it was not a fence to keep the scurrying priests in, as was the first impression. No, rather it was to keep the soldiers out. It seemed that Bishop Domitus and the priests had still not given up hope that the Lord Constable's occupation of their cathedral would be less than permanent. As they climbed the stairs, they had to show their parchment to three more guards in turn. All of these more alert than those at the massive front door, either because they were inside out of the sun or else due to their increased proximity to the object of protection. At last, they stood in a crowded guardroom before a seam-faced, gap-toothed veteran whose belt full of keys and air of harried disinterest bespoke authority.
"Yes, the Lord Breogar's here today. Give me the letter and I'll be passing it on."
The sergeant scratched his chin impassively.
"No, sir. We must give it to him. It's from Dr. Morgani's."
Simon tried to sound firm. Jeremias was staring at the floor.
"Oh, is it then? Well, think of that."
The man spat on the sawdust-covered floor. Here and there the gleam of marble tile showed through.
"Aiden, bite me, what a day. Wait here, then."
"So, what have we here?"
Count Breogar, sitting at the table beside the bony remnants of a meal of small birds, raised an eyebrow. He had delicate features, nearly lost in jowly flesh, and the hands of a musician, fine, long-fingered hands.
"A letter, my lord."
Simon on one knee extended the tube of parchment.
"Well, give it to me then, boy. Can't you see I'm at dinner?"
The Count's voice was high-pitched and effeminate, but Simon had heard that Breogar was a terrifying swordsman. Those slender hands had killed many men. As the Count read the message, lips moving, shiny with grease, Simon tried to keep his shoulders straight and his back stiff as a pike handle. Out of the corner of his eye, he thought he saw the grizzled sergeant looking at him, so he tilted his chin back and stared straight ahead, thinking about what a favorable comparison he must make to the slouching dullards on watch at the cathedral doors.
"Please consider the bearers for service under your lordship's guidance,"
Breogar read aloud. His emphasis gave Simon a panicky moment. Had he noticed the S Simon had added to bearer? He had made it a bit squeezy so it would fit. Count Breogar, his eyes on Simon, handed the letter to the staff sergeant. As the sergeant read, slower even than Breogar, the nobleman looked the youth up and down, then flicked a brief glance to the still kneeling Jeremias. When the sergeant handed the letter back, he wore a smile that showed two teeth missing and a pink tongue probing in the dark gulf.
"So,"
Breogar fluted the sound like a sorrowful breath.
"Morgani's, the old apothecary, wants me to take on a couple of castle mice and turn them into men."
He picked up a tiny haunch from his plate and chewed on the bone.
"Impossible."
Simon felt his knees buckle and his stomach push up toward his throat.
But why?" he stammered.
"Because I don't need you. I have fighting men enough. I can't afford you. No one can plant if it doesn't rain. And I have men lined up already looking for a job of work that will feed them. But most important, I don't want you. A couple of suet-soft castle boys who have felt nothing more painful in their lives than a smack on their pink asses for stealing cherries. Go on with you. If war comes, if those sneering heathen in Hernesteer continue to resist the king's will, or treacherous Joshua turns up, then you can carry a pitchfork or scythe with the rest of the peasants. Maybe you can even follow the army and water the horses, if manpower gets short enough. But you'll never be soldiers. The king didn't make me Lord Constable to nursemaid groundlings. Sergeant, show these castle mice a hole to scamper out.
Neither Simon nor Jeremiah said a word all the long journey back to the hayholt. When Simon was alone in his curtained alcove, he broke his barrel-stave sword over his knee. He did not cry. He would not cry.
There is something strange in the north wind today, thought Iskrimnor. Something that smells like an animal, or a storm about to happen, or both. Some scratchy thing that puts the hair on my neck right up.
He rubbed his hands together as though the air were cold, which it was not, and pushed the sleeves of his light summer tunic, worn months early in this oddest of years, up over his corded old forearms. He went again to the doorway and looked out, feeling embarrassed that an old soldier like himself should be playing such stripling's games.
Where is that damned Hernesteer man?
Turning to pace again, he nearly tripped over a stack of writing boxes, instead catching a boot buckle in the bottommost of a small pyramid of parchment scrolls that hemmed in his confined walking space. Cursing roundly, he bent in time to keep the arrangement from toppling. Certainly the deserted room in the Hall of Records, emptied so that the writing priests could make their Elysiomancer observances, was as good a place as could be found on short notice for a clandestine meeting. But why couldn't they leave enough room among their damned daubings for a grown man to move around? The door latch rattled. Duke Iskrimnor, relieved of waiting at last, sprang forward. Instead of peering out cautiously, he flung the door open to find not two men as expected, but one.
"Praise Aiden, you're here, Eole," he barked. "Where's the escritor?"
"Shh!" The Count of Nad Mullach held two fingers to his lips as he entered, pulling the door closed behind him.
"More quiet. The archive master is nattering about just up the hall."
"And why should I care?"
the Duke exclaimed, but not so loudly as the first time.
"Are we children to hide from that leathery old eunuch?"
"If you wanted a meeting that all know about,"
Eolair asked, settling himself on a stool, "then why are we hiding in a closet?"
"It's no closet," the Rimmersman grumbled. "And you know perfectly well why I told you to come here, and why no secret is safe in the inner keep. Where's Escritor Veligus?"
"He felt that a closet was no place for the lector's right-hand man."
Eolair laughed. Iskrimnor did not. He thought the Hernesteerman drunk by his flushed face, or at least a little so. He wished he were the same.
"I thought it important that we meet somewhere we could talk freely," Iskrimnor said, a little defensively. "We have been much seen in deep conversation lately."
"No, Iskrimnor, it's you that's right."
Eolair waved a hand reassuringly. He was dressed for the Lady Day celebrations, playing the part of respectful outsider, a part which the pagan Hernesteri had learned well. His festival tunic of white was belted three times, each belt covered in gold or enameled metals, and his long mane of black hair was pulled back behind his head and tied with golden ribbon.
"I was only making a joke, and a sad joke it is," he resumed, "when King John's loyal subjects must meet in secret to speak of things which are no treason."
Iskrimnor moved slowly to the door and juggled the latch, making sure it had closed. He turned, putting his wide back against the wood and crossed his arms across his substantial chest. He too was dressed for the festivities in a fine, lightweight blue tunic and hose, but the braids of his beard had already been frayed loose by nervous tugging, and the hose bagged at the knee. Escrimnor hated dressing up.
"Well," he growled at last, tilting his head defiantly, "should I speak first, or will you?"
"There is no need to worry who will speak first," the Count said.
For a moment the flush of Eolaire's face, the color on his high, thin cheekbones, reminded the older man of something he had seen once years ago. A haunting figure glimpsed across 50 yards of Rimmersgaard snow.
"One of the white foxes. My father called that one."
Escrimnor wondered if the old stories were true. Was there really Scythi blood in the Hernesteri noble houses? Eolaire ran a hand across his forehead as he continued speaking, blotting away the tiny droplets of sweat, and the momentary likeness was gone.
"We have spoken enough to know that things have gone fiercely wrong. What we need to speak on, and what we need privacy to speak on."
He waved his hand at the cluttered archive room, a dark nest of paper and parchment lit by a high triangular window.
"Is what we can do about it. If anything. But that is it. What can be done?"
Escrimnor was not yet willing to jump so boldly into talk that whatever Eolaire might say had already the faint sickening tang of treason.
"It's this way," he said. "I would be the last to hold Elias to blame for this bedamned weather. I should know. While it's hot as the devil's breath and dry as a bone here, in my land in the north we're having a terrible winter, snows and ice that beat anything remembered. So weather here is no fault of the king's, any more than the roofs collapsed and the cattle frozen in the barn halls in Rimmersgaard are mine."
He tugged fiercely, and another beard braid raveled loose, the ribbon hanging limply down from the grey tangle.
"Of course, Elias is to blame for keeping me here while my kinsfolk and people suffer. But that is another line and another hook. No, it's that the man doesn't seem to care. The wells drying up, the farms lying fallow, starving people sleeping in the fields and cities, a choke with the plague. And he seems not to notice. The taxes and levies go up. Those bedamned, arse-licking pups of the nobility he has befriended ring him round all day drinking and singing and fighting and...
The old duke grunted in disgust.
"And the tournaments. Odin's red spear. I was as much for the tourney as any man in my day. But Erkenland is crumbling to dust beneath his father's throne. The countries of the High Ward are restless as a spooked colt, and still the tournaments go on, and the barge parties on the Kinslaw, and the jugglers and the tumblers and the bear baitings. It's as bad as what they say of the worst days of Craxis the Goat."
Red in the face himself now, Escrimnor balled his fists and stared at the floor.
"In Hernesteer,"
Eolaire's voice was soft and musical after the Rimmersman's hoarse tirade,
"we say a shepherd, not a butcher, meaning a king should preserve his land and people like a flock, taking from them only what he needs to get by. Not use them up until there's nothing left to do but eat what remains."
Eolaire stared at the small window and the particles of parchment dust that eddied in its diffuse light.
"That's what Elias is doing. Eating his land, bite by bite. As surely as did the giant Croichmafareg once devour the mountain at Cranhir."
"He was a good man once. Elias was,"
Escrimnor said wonderingly.
far easier to deal with than his brother. Surely not all men are meant for kingship. But it seems more is wrong than just a man made ill by power. Something is damnably wrong. And it is not only Fangbald and Breyogar and those who are leading him to the cliff. The Duke had somewhat regained his breath. You know it is that vicious bastard Priratis who fills his head with strange notions and keeps him up nights in that tower with lights and unholy noises, until sometimes it seems that the king does not know where he is when the sun is up. What could Elias want from such a creature as that whoreson priest? He is king of the known world. What could Priratis possibly have to offer him? Aeolus stood, still with eyes fixed to the light above, and dampened his sleeve against his forehead. I wish I knew, he said at last. So, what then is there to do? Escrimnor narrowed his old fierce eyes. What said Escritor Velikis? It is after all Mother Church's cathedral that is confiscate at St. Sutrin's. It is Duke Leobardus Nabene's ships, along with your King Luth's, that Guthwulf has stolen under the lie of plague danger at the sovereign harbor of Abangeet. Leobardus and Lector Ranesson are close. They rule Naben like one two-headed monarch. Surely, Velikis must have had something to say on his master's behalf. He has much to say, but little of substance, my friend. Aeolus slumped back on his stool. The bright shaft of sunlight was diminished now, its source partially blocked as the sun sank, the little room in even denser shadow. Of what Duke Leobardus thinks of this act of piracy? 3 grain ships thieved outright in a Hernestia harbor. Velikis professes not to know. On his master's behalf he is as ever vague. His sacredness Ranesson, I think, has designs to be a peacemaker between Elias and Duke Leobardus, and perhaps at the same time improve the position of your Aedanite church here at court. My master, King Luth, has directed me next to travel to Naben, and perhaps I will find out the truth of that when I am there. I fear, however, that if such is the case, the Lector has misjudged. If the snubbing that Elias and his sycophants have given Velikis is any indication, the king is more restless even than his father was under Mother Church's broad shadow. So many plots, Escrimnor groaned. So many intrigues. It makes my head swim. I am not a man for such things. Give me a sword or an axe, and let me deal blows. Is that why you have taken to closets? Aeolus smiled and produced from beneath his cloak a skin of sour honey mead. There does not seem anyone to swing at here. I think you are taking rather well to intrigue late in life, my good duke. Escrimnor frowned and took the offered skin. He's a born intriguer himself, our Aeolus, he thought. I should be grateful, if nothing else, to have someone to talk to. For all that Hernestiri poetry talk I've heard him trot out for the ladies, he's hard as shield steel underneath. A good ally for treacherous times. There's something else. Escrimnor handed the skin back to Aeolus and wiped his mouth. The count took a long swallow and then nodded his head. Out with it, I'm all ears like a Kirkoyle hare. That dead man, old Morgane's found, out in the Kinswood, Escrimnor said. The arrow-shot one. Aeolus nodded again. He was mine. Bindasek by name. Although by the time he was discovered, I would never have known him but for a broken bone in his face that was got in an earlier service for me. Of course, I said nothing.
Yours?
Eole cocked an eyebrow. And doing what? Do you know? Iskrimnor laughed a short, barking sound.
Certainly. That is why I kept quiet. I sent him out when Skarli of Coldskrika took his kinsmen and departed north. Sharpnose has been making too many new friends among Elias' court for my liking. So I sent Bindesek out with a message to my son Ishorn. As long as Elias is keeping me here with these ridiculous errands, these shows of mock diplomacy that he claims are so important. And if they were so important, why entrust them to a blunt old war dog like me? Then I wanted Ishorn to be on a special close watch. I don't trust Skarli any more than I would a starving wolf. And my son has troubles enough at home already, from what I hear. All the reports that have trickled down across the Frost March are bad. Raging storms in the north, the roads unsafe. Villagers forced to huddle together in the main halls. It makes for troubled times, and Skarli knows that.
Do you think then it was Skarli killed your man? Eole leaned forward, passing the skin back.
I don't know, to be sure.
The Duke tipped back his head for another long swallow, the muscles in his thick neck pulsing. A thin drizzle of mead spattered down his blue tunic.
What I mean is, it's the most obvious thing, but I have many doubts.
He wiped at the stain absently for a moment.
First of all, even if he caught Bindesek, it's an act of treason to kill him. For all his contempt, Skarli is my liege man, and I am his liege lord.